My name is Sir Andrew Davis. I'm the music director of Lyric Opera of Chicago, and I'd like to speak to you about Richard Wagner's opera Tannhäuser. The excerpts you will hear are from a Warner Classics recording, featuring Gottlob Frick as Hermann, Hans Hopf as Tannhäuser, Dietrich Fischer-Dieskau as Wolfram, Fritz Wunderlich as Walter, Elisabeth Grümmer as Elisabeth, and Marianne Schech as Venus. Franz Konvitschny conducts the chorus and orchestra of the Staatsoper Berlin. Special thanks to Nicholas Ivor Martin for his help in preparing this commentary. If opera has a fulcrum, a single work that turned the opera world away from the classical and into the modern age, a single work that determined how composers approached opera composition forever after, a single work that changed how conductors, singers, designers, and directors reinterpreted operas that had come before, if there were such a work, that work would not be Wagner's Tannhäuser. Tannhäuser shows us how Wagner got where he was going, but that destination was Tristan und Isolde. With Tristan, it's widely agreed, Wagner broke the mold. Tristan changed how we think about chromaticism. Dissonances that had been handled with delicacy and hesitancy for centuries before became not only acceptable but sought after. Tristan changed how we think about harmony and melody. The density of Wagner's thematic motifs blurred the distinction between the two. A Wagner leitmotif might be played across different instruments and modulated in fantastic ways. The music was no longer a simple melody, with the orchestra going oom-pa-pa in the background. Tristan changed how we think about orchestration. The orchestra, in his later works, has as important a dramatic function as the performers on stage. The orchestra, through the use of recurring musical phrases called leitmotifs, comments on the action, drawing dramaturgical connections of which the characters on stage may be unaware. And Tristan changed what we expect on stage. It was no longer dramatic enough to split the evening between declamatory recitative that furthered the plot and bravura arias in which characters declared their feelings. Every element of the performance had to contribute to the drama. The music had to flow seamlessly and continuously from curtain up to curtain down. If this sounds oversimplified, it is. Look at the two men, both born in 1813, who dominated 19th century opera, Richard Wagner and Giuseppe Verdi. Verdi claimed to be uninfluenced by his contemporary, but there is no doubt that his two last operas, Otello and Falstaff, draw on musical and dramatic principles articulated and championed by Wagner and his followers. Wagner's contribution was so great that it pulled even such a colossus as Verdi in its wake. Yet, to say that Tristan is the fulcrum implies that it lies at the midpoint between the old and the new. And in many ways, this is not true. Tristan lit the path forward. It was the Gesamtkunstwerk, the total unified work of art that Wagner had been working towards his entire creative life. Tristan is whole. To see a work in transition, we do better to look at Wagner's real middle period opera, Tannhäuser. Tannhäuser was the work that Wagner himself claimed never to have completed. 3 weeks before the composer's death, his wife Cosima wrote in her diary, "He says he still owes the world Tannhäuser." Because of the history of the work, this was as much a literal as an artistic or philosophical statement. Premiered at Dresden in 1845, the opera had a disappointing, though not disastrous, reception. At the time, Wagner had a good job in Dresden. He was the Royal Saxon Court conductor, a job he had won after the successful premiere at the Dresden Court Theatre of his opera Rienzi. 15 years would pass before Wagner was to revise Tannhäuser, and a lot happened in those 15 years. He fled his comfortable post in Germany to escape punishment for his participation in the liberal uprisings of 1848. He published his renowned essays, The Artwork of the Future, and Opera and Drama, as well as his infamous tract, Judaism in Music. He composed and premiered the first two of his Ring operas. He composed and premiered the earth-shaking Tristan und Isolde. And he began work on a second opera about medieval German troubadours, Die Meistersinger. The Wagner who was approached about revising Tannhäuser for a Paris premiere in 1861 was, artistically, politically, philosophically, not the man who had originally written it. Add to this that the Paris premiere of the revised work would be one of the most notorious artistic disasters of the century, on a par with the riot that broke out 52 years later when Igor Stravinsky's Rite of Spring was premiered at the Champs-Élysées. After the hostile reception of Tannhäuser, Wagner would abandon all hope of having an artistic triumph in Paris, then the centre of the operatic universe. But he would continue to revise the opera itself, making further changes for a production in Vienna in 1875. The year before, he would open the permanent festival in Bayreuth devoted to his legacy. If this history were not reason enough for Wagner to consider his Tannhäuser unfinished as his own death drew near, there were others. The 19th century saw a fundamental shift in the relationship between artist and audience, a shift initiated by Ludwig van Beethoven and Wagner's friend and soon-to-be father-in-law Franz Liszt, but also adopted by Wagner himself. For all their genius, Mozart and Haydn were middle-class employees of noble patrons, performing a craft. They may not have been shoemakers or blacksmiths, but the intellectual, social, and creative mystique of the artist had yet to be invented. Wagner, like Beethoven and Liszt, demanded and received a different level of respect, something between adoration and veneration. It was they who invented the celebrity superstar artist. Verdi was no stranger to adulation, but even after he had become an international superstar, he would still write that the box office is the proper thermometer of success. The audience, he felt, was judge, jury, and if need be, executioner, and rightly so. Verdi would have doubts about premiering his final opera Falstaff, for fear that he had indulged himself as an artist, and thereby lost sight of his audience. It would be an understatement to say that Wagner craved adulation. He believed it was the composer's job to show his audience what was beautiful and artistic, and the audience's responsibility to accept and worship. The artist-composer would henceforth lead, not follow. The relationship between artist and audience is never so simple. Mozart and Haydn challenged their audiences plenty, and generations of composers after Wagner have learned the cost of getting too far ahead of the listener. Artists who forget their audience cannot expect to be applauded, or, more important, to be understood. But that Verdi should have had doubts about Falstaff, one of the greatest operas of all time, is hard for us today to understand. Tannhäuser is a case study not only in the transition from classical to modern opera, but also in the transition from composer as made-to-order cook to composer as visionary and leader. The disastrous opening of the revised Tannhäuser in Paris is often blamed on the ballet. The opera itself was already in many ways a prototypical French grand opera. It had arias and recitatives, and it had choruses and processions. The one element it was missing in the 1845 version was a ballet. And the opera was not going to allow it to be premiered without one. So Wagner, who had been requested to do the Paris revision by the Emperor Napoleon III, complied. More or less. Convention dictated that the ballet be placed in the second act, and the story goes that by placing the ballet at the beginning of Act I, Wagner infuriated the members of the influential jockey club. These young aristocrats were in the habit of arriving late after dinner, seeing their girlfriends in the corps de ballet, and then leaving early. On discovering that they would have to be on time if they wanted to see the ballet, the jockey club members led the audience in whistles and catcalls that repeatedly interrupted the performances. Furious, Wagner withdrew the production. The catcalls were real enough, but the culinary habits of popinjay Parisians were not the only reason for them. The rule about ballet placement in grand opera was far from sacrosanct. Even such pillars of the form as Meyerbeer did not always comply. His popular Les Huguenots features a ballet in the second act, but his equally popular Le Prophète delays the big ballet until Act III. Charles Gounod's Faust, which premiered 2 years before Tannhäuser, put the ballet in Act IV, although it was exempt since it premiered at the Théâtre Lyrique, not the Opéra. Wagner had hoped to present Tannhäuser at the Lyrique, but the decision had been taken out of his hands. Rossini's Guillaume Tell even featured a ballet in Act I. Tannhäuser, however, had two other strikes against it in the eyes of the Jockey Club members. First, Wagner was not a son of France, but an outsider, a German. Even more damning were the affiliations of the person who had first suggested to Napoleon III that he request the opera. This was Princess Pauline Clémentine von Metternich. She was in Paris because her husband, Richard von Metternich, was the Austrian ambassador to France. Since one of the primary aims of Austrian diplomacy of the time was to curtail French power, Richard was not a Parisian favourite. Worse, Pauline was related to Chancellor Clemens von Metternich twice. The Chancellor was her grandfather on her mother's side. He was also her father-in-law. And he was the principal architect of the plan hatched at the Congress of Vienna to keep France down after the defeat of Napoleon. Pauline was a passionate patron of the arts, particularly music. In 1892, at the age of 56, she participated in one of the earliest documented female duels, wounding and being wounded in return by her adversary, the Countess Kielmansegg. The cause of the duel was the arrangements over the Vienna Musical and Theatrical Exhibition. Pauline took her opera seriously. Her husband was more passionate about prima donnas, with several of whom he reportedly had affairs. Whether or not a second-act ballet would have averted the catastrophe of the premiere, Wagner's attitude towards Parisian sensibilities was one of antagonism. Not only had he defied the convention of putting the ballet in Act II, he had reacted to criticism by withdrawing the entire opera from presentation. Artists had reacted badly to criticism before, but Wagner was redefining the relationship of the composer to his audience. It's important to realise that Wagner's reason for putting the ballet at the beginning was entirely sound artistically. The first act is set in the magical Venusberg, a subterranean kingdom ruled by Venus, the goddess of love. Tannhäuser is a willing participant in the goddess's round-the-clock bacchanal. And what better way to express physicality and sensuality than in dance? Tannhäuser is a troubadour, a medieval poet who also composed music, and he sings a love song to Venus. There was a real Tannhäuser, a poet who lived in the 13th century and performed at the court of Frederick II of Austria. We know remarkably little about him, but after his death, the legend around him grew to eclipse the man. By the 15th century, we hear that Tannhäuser spent a year living underground in the mythical Venusberg, and that eventually he repented and went on a pilgrimage to Rome to ask forgiveness of Pope Urban IV. Tannhäuser's Ballad to the Goddess ends with a plea to be set free. He yearns to leave the sensual world for the spiritual. No sooner has he expressed this realization than the Venusberg dissolves around him. With the disappearance of the Venusberg, Tannhäuser finds himself back in Wartburg, a real castle in Thuringia, Germany, and the setting for a historical minstrels' contest. As you can hear, Wagner does not cushion the shock of this transition from the magical and mythical to the real, he emphasises it. In the original 1845 version of the opera, Tannhäuser's farewell to Venus was final. She does not again appear on stage. The transition would frankly confuse his original audiences. In his later operas, Wagner would continue to draw heavily on German history and myth, but his blending of fact and fiction would be less jarring. The magic in Lohengrin, The Ring, and Parsifal forms part of the reality of those worlds. It's not allegorical or metaphorical. It really is possible to have a helmet transform you into a toad or to be ferried around by a swan. Meistersinger, instead, is firmly grounded in a recognizable, if fictionalized, reality. Act 1 ends with the newly repentant Tannhäuser encountering a group of pilgrims. Their chant is among the most memorable in the opera, but it is also shockingly dissonant. Again, we hear a composer in transition. Tannhäuser leaves Wartburg in shame after being beaten in a singing competition, but he's welcomed back by his fellow poets with open arms. Act 2 is a singing contest that foreshadows the last act of Die Meistersinger. Elisabeth, the woman Tannhäuser left behind when he left for the Venusberg, is overjoyed to hear that he has returned, and she agrees to preside at the upcoming singing competition. The winner will be granted a wish by Elisabeth, and the presiding Landgrave announces that the subject for the competition is Love's Awakening. This inspires Tannhäuser's friend Wolfram to compare love to a stream, pure and unadulterated. Notice that this still sounds very much like a classic aria. Wagner's ultimate dissolution of the distinction between recitative and aria was still in progress as he was composing Tannhäuser. Not surprisingly, Wolfram does not get the last word. Tannhäuser asserts that true love is something hotter and counters with his own rousing paean to Venus. Tannhäuser's display of pagan passion has scandalized the assembled singers and audience, and only Elisabeth stands up for him. Realizing he has gone too far, Tannhäuser apologizes and is allowed to leave with the pilgrims. Perhaps in Rome, the Pope will forgive his sins. If Act 2 resembled a proto-Meistersinger, Act 3 of Tannhäuser has elements that Wagner will reuse and hone in all of his later works. The importance of redemption will figure prominently in Parsifal and The Ring. Tannhäuser's pilgrimage to Rome occurs offstage between the second and third acts. exactly where Wagner will later position Parsifal's world travels as he, too, seeks redemption. Autumn has come to Wartburg, and Elisabeth prays for the return of her beloved. Wolfram, who also loves Elisabeth, is less hopeful. In his Song to the Evening Star, he has a premonition of death covering the earth. Tannhäuser has returned, but his pilgrimage has failed. The Pope has refused his request for absolution, and in a remarkably derisive way. The Pope has told Tannhäuser that it is more likely the papal staff will sprout leaves than that the troubadour will be forgiven. This is a central point in the legend that grew up around the historical Tannhäuser. Left with little alternative, Tannhäuser calls to Venus, who appears and welcomes him back to her cave. This tantalizing vision is interrupted by a funeral procession. Elisabeth's long suffering has ended, and mourners bear her corpse down the hill. Tannhäuser is shattered. As he begs for forgiveness from her corpse, a young pilgrim arrives with startling news. The Pope's staff has sprouted leaves. God has heard Tannhäuser's plea and forgiven him. The opera ends with a pilgrim's chorus praising this miracle of salvation. Original sound recordings of musical excerpts used by permission of Warner Classics.